And we're back here on 93.3 CFMU FM on Unusual Sources, bringing you the sources you don't ordinarily get to hear in the corporate media. And certainly today we're going to be bringing you a viewpoint you're not hearing right now. And of course, I'm speaking on the Iranian elections. And we've brought with us today Zafar Bengash. And that's Zafar Bengash, the editor, writer, journalist, and community leader, as well as Islamic scholar. And certainly I received his recent comments and article on the elections by email, so I felt that we should definitely bring this up. So, Zafar, thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Brandon, and I'm glad that you want to talk about the Iranian elections, because regrettably there has been a lot of ill-informed talk about it. And in fact, I'd like to invite your listeners to our website. I've put that article on our website as well, which is www.muslimmedia.com. So they can go and read that as well. But I'd be more than happy to discuss whatever aspect you want to discuss regarding the June 12th elections in Iran.
Well, certainly. I'd love to discuss the selective focus. I mean, on the one hand, or I guess first, I'm supposed to feel bad that Ahmadinejad won. I'm supposed to have an opinion already formed about that for me by the media. And I'm supposed to believe that the election was rigged. But in terms of evidence, is there any solid evidence that the election is rigged? Is there any reason to believe, for example, that Mousavi would have won?
Absolutely not. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. In fact, let me first share some of the misconceptions that have deliberately been created. The first is that most media reports were saying before the elections that Mousavi had the momentum and his rallies were very well attended and so on, This was basically based on several sort of misreadings of the situation. Number one, that many of these reporters, whether it's television reporters or others, are based in Tehran. And these reporters, of course, primarily reported from North Tehran, which is no doubt a stronghold of Mousavi supporters. And so it would be natural for people to see Mousavi's rallies well attended in North Tehran. But North Tehran people are also those who belong to the upper crust of society. And these people have traditionally been opposed to the Islamic Revolution itself, right from day one. In fact, I recall as far back as 1982, when I first went to Iran and I stayed in Istiklal Hotel, which is in the upper posh locality of Tehran. We could hear when we met people, these rich people who would come to the hotel, they would have their coffee and cakes and pastries and so on, and they'd be grumbling about, whatever was wrong with Iran. But when one went to the southern part of Tehran, for instance, or outside Tehran itself, then there was a totally different picture. So that's one aspect. The other is that even before the elections, Ahmadinejad's rallies were attended by even larger crowds, but that is something that was seldom reflected in the media, because there was an inherent bias in the media against Ahmadinejad. So basically what the media, whether it was the print or the electronic media, were reflecting was their own inherent bias and their wishful thinking that they wanted to see Ahmadinejad defeated. And when that wishful thinking was not realized, and they had absolutely no evidence to back their allegations, then they said, well, how could Ahmadinejad win? There must have been a fraud. In fact, let me mention to you that the Interior Ministry that is responsible for vote counting and so on, when they were asked about these vote rigging allegations, the spokesperson said, we have not received a single written complaint from any candidate about precisely what and how and what complaint do they have about vote rigging. They said that we have only heard people making statements in press conferences, but he said we as the ministry cannot go by press conferences. If there are candidates that feel that there have been any irregularities, then they should let us know. And let me point out to you exactly what was the complaint that Mr. Mousavi finally lodged. he said that there were some polling stations where the ballot papers ran out. That was one complaint. Secondly, he said that there were some polling stations that were not allowed to remain open after the time had elapsed. Now, I know for a fact, and even, you know, reports here have confirmed that many polling stations were left open way past the deadline because there were so many people outside. Now, the turnout in the election was 85%, something that is unheard of here in North America or in much of Europe, or in fact, all of Europe. And so, you know, for people to sort of then immediately jump to conclusions that there must have been rigging because the result did not turn out to be the way they had anticipated, it is just nothing but sheer propaganda.
Well, in terms of anticipation, I've seen some of the Western polls, and basically it did show that Ahmadinejad was in the lead. Looking at the organizations that did polling, Terror Free Tomorrow, the Center for Public Opinion, the New America Foundation, and KA Europe and SPRL, they did polling as Western agencies prior to the election, and they projected that Ahmadinejad was in the lead significantly. So I think the people that had the information did know that he was going to win, but what happens when there's an election in a country that is in the sights of the Americans, you always get the media projecting the win of the opposition candidate or projecting high gains by the opposition candidate so that they can portray an election as rigged if it doesn't go the way they wanted it to.
Exactly. You see, you can also see that, you know, even where in situations where the media cannot make those allegations, for instance, you know, the immediate example that comes to mind is Hamas's victory in Palestine in January of 2006. I mean, there's absolutely nothing that the media can say with respect to Hamas's convincing victory, but then they say, well, it's a terrorist organization, so that's the end of the story. Therefore, you know, we don't recognize them. So it is not as if, simply winning the elections are enough. Wherever they cannot come up with any other argument, then they simply dismiss it as a terrorist organization or beyond the pale and so on. But as you said, with respect to Iran, the various non-governmental organizations that were doing polling of Iran, they found that Ahmadinejad was ahead by 2-1 throughout the country. And in fact, they emphasized that they did their polling in all of the 30 provinces of Iran. And it's important that people do not get swayed by what they see in Tehran, particularly in North Tehran, because North Tehran does not represent the overall Iranian society. Now, let me indicate something else to you. In fact, this organization, Terror Free Tomorrow, in their survey, they said that the strongest support for Ahmadinejad was in the age group between 18 to 24. Now, that would appear quite surprising to a lot of people if they were to go by the images that they see on their television screen of rallies in support of Mousavi, because in most of these rallies, there are university students participating. There is no doubt that that Mousavi's support came primarily from university students in Tehran and other places, but these are not a representative sample of the Iranian society. The overwhelming majority of Iranian people live outside the cities, and Ahmadinejad, during his four-year presidential term, during his last campaign in 2005, he had promised that he would put the oil money from the oil revenues on the tables of the poor people of Iran, and he did. He went to the countryside. In fact, he visited every province in Iran twice, not just once, twice during his presidency, and then, of course, during the presidential campaign as well. This was something that no other president had done at all in the previous 30 years. So you can see that Ahmadinejad went out of his way to court people in the countryside because that's where the majority of the people live. Now, who are his supporters? The urban poor, the rural poor, and the religiously inclined people. Now, these people constitute the overwhelming majority of the population of Iran. 65 to 70% of that population.
That's why, I mean, and you mentioned dangerous misconceptions, and I think there's a tendency by some journalists and some commentators to say, well, in terms of people who voted against Ahmadinejad, that would be women or youth or urban residents, but that's simply not the case.
Exactly. You see, I've been to Iran many times, and I can tell you Tehran itself is a, like, you know, there's a very clear divide in Tehran between those who live in the north of Tehran, where all these major hotels are located, and those who live in the south of Tehran. And I can tell you that, you know, I went to the south of Tehran because that is where a major cemetery is located. It is referred to as the Behisht-e-Zahra Cemetery, and that's where Imam Khomeini is buried as well. In the early 80s, the south of Tehran was a very poor, dilapidated area. And now, of course, you know, there is a new airport just close to Behisht-e-Zahra Cemetery. It's called the Imam Khomeini International Airport, and now most international flights go there. So when you get out of the airport and you drive on the highway going to the north, of course, the hotels are still in the north of Tehran, one can see clearly the massive changes and transformation that has come about in South Tehran, where, you know, successive governments, but particularly Ahmadinejad's government, has built houses for the poor. There are massive parks that have been built. There has been a massive tree plantation program. And in fact, you know, the whole of South Tehran has been transformed. And that is the area where the vast majority of the people are poor, people who are sort of, you know, barely making ends meet.
Well,
and these are the people, these are the foot soldiers of Ahmadinejad's campaign and his supporters.
That's what they call buying votes, right? Because every time I watch CNN, they say, well, Ahmadinejad was buying the voters. He was buying off the poor. So if you have public works programs, if you have large public parks, if you have urban redevelopment, that's buying off the poor.
Well, exactly. That's how they make the allegation. But, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned buying votes. Only a few days prior to the Iranian elections, there was election in Lebanon. And, you know, the Saudi government spent millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, to get people of Lebanese origin to go back to Lebanon to vote for the Hariri coalition, which is referred to as the pro-Western coalition. I mean, you know, there were hundreds of people that were taken here from Canada as well. The CBC reported this, the Globe and Mail reported this, but when the election was over and the Hariri camp had, you know, won the election as opposed to the coalition led by Hezbollah, then all the newspaper reports simply said, Hezbollah defeated, pro-Iranian, pro-Syrian Hezbollah defeated in Lebanon, without mentioning that, you know, there was massive vote buying in Lebanon. But just because their favorite alliance won that election, so that was okay. But in Iran, when Ahmadinejad went and provided services to the people, then that is referred to as vote buying.
Well, Americans, if you ask them about the Iranian elections, they're going to be able to tell you things that they learn in the news. It's in American consciousness, it's in Canadian consciousness, and the reason they're so informed about it is because our own media, CNN, Fox News, and so on, is so fixated on Iran, not in Lebanon, where we got what we wanted. No one talks about what happened in Georgia, for example. There was yet again repression of Georgians, repression of demonstrators, but that's a pro-U.S. regime, so
correct.
We don't hear about it.
That's correct, and also the fact that you know, much of the information regarding Iran, for instance, and, you know, when if one examines the media coverage over the last several years, there are two or three aspects that are constantly talked about. One is Iran's alleged attempts to make a nuclear bomb. Secondly, that Ahmadinejad wants to wipe out Israel. And third, that, you know, the majority of the people in Iran hate this Islamic government, they want to reject this theocracy, and so on. All of these things are absolutely false allegations, and yet they are endlessly repeated in order to paint these very ugly caricatures of Ahmadinejad and of Iran's Islamic revolution. The bottom line really is that Iran is the only country in the third world that has successfully broken out of the stranglehold of the world order that was created after the Second World War, in which the West was going to be was to be dominant, and it would dictate to the rest of the world, and that everybody else had to simply line up behind whatever the U.S. or, you know, Europe wanted. And since Iran has broken out of that stranglehold because of its successful revolution 30 years ago, that it has not been forgiven for that, and every attempt is being made in order to undermine it. And I can also share with you that there is a terrorist organization called Jundullah, which means the Army of God. It operates from the Pakistani province of Balochistan, and it carries out terrorist activities in Iran's Balochistan province. And only a few weeks ago, in fact, on May 28th, there was a massive bombing that they carried out, a bomb that was planted in a mosque in the city of Zahedan, which is the capital of Balochistan province in Iran. And about 25 or 26 people were killed while they were in a mosque. Several scores of people were injured. And this was carried out by these terrorists of Jundullah, who was aligned with Al-Qaeda. Now, just consider this. On the one hand, the U.S. and the West say that Al-Qaeda are terrorists, and yet, on the other hand, the CIA is actually financing Jundullah to carry out these terrorist acts in Iran.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention that, because I think there's two problems that Iran faces here. And one, there is this threat of aggression, of violent actions. There's, you know, United States and Israel are openly threatening Iran on many occasions. They've openly admitted that they're funding groups that are hostile to the regime, and including groups outside of Iran that are armed and militant groups. But they also face a threat within the political sphere, because you can read published reports in the Western media from newspapers like the Washington Post or New York Times about U.S. government programs to infiltrate Iran's political sphere. And that goes back a long time, because the Iranians were burned very badly the last time the U.S. was heavily involved in Iran's politics, with the Shah and the U.S. involvement there. So I think they have a lot of reason to be very afraid of the way that the United States and other countries would try to conduct themselves inside Iran's political sphere.
Exactly. In fact, you know, in May of 2007, this was reported by the ABC News, by the way, on May 24th, 2007, former U.S. President George Bush signed an executive order authorizing $400 million to destabilize Iran. This was, you know, reported by ABC, not something that, you know, we are making out. It is available on the internet as well. Those who want to Google that, they can go and check it on YouTube. In fact, as part of that campaign, money was sent into Iran to instigate these various anti-government elements to destabilize the government, to indulge in psychological warfare, to carry out black operations and so on. And this campaign has been going on since that time. There is absolutely no evidence to suggest that this has come to an end. In fact, only 2 days ago, the former chief of Pakistan's army, General Aslam Beg, who was, you know, chief of the army in the late 80s and early 90s, he said in a television interview that the U.S. CIA destabilization program of Iran is still continuing. Now, obviously, a former army chief of Pakistan is not going to make such a statement unless and until he has solid evidence to back that. And he's a very responsible person. He's not somebody given to loose talk. And so we can see that there is ample evidence to the fact that the Americans are still involved in destabilizing Iran, despite Obama's soothing statements that he wants to have good relations with Iran. In fact, I believe that that is part of the campaign to divert attention from America's real intention, and it is to perhaps disarm those who are suspicious of American policies and American intentions. You would say, well, look, you know, we are interested in having good relations with you, while at the same time, America is continuing with its disruptive policy in Iran. I also want to point out that, in fact, America is in violation of its own agreement with Iran of January of 1981. it is referred to as the Algiers Accord, which America and Iran signed, under which, you know, the American hostages were released, and America promised, and in fact wrote, that neither directly nor indirectly, neither militarily, politically, or any other way, would America undertake to destabilize Iran or to interfere in its internal affairs. And yet here we have, in May of 2007, and even prior to that, but specifically in May 2007, Bush signed an executive order, which obviously did not have congressional approval, that he authorized $400 million to be used to destabilize Iran.
Well, there's a lot happening outside of Iran. There's the geopolitics. But I'm wondering, inside Iran, what about Mr. Mousavi? Now, I know he had been the prime minister in the past in Iran. I mean, what's the difference between him and Ahmadinejad?
Okay. Let me first of all tell you that Mousavi was the prime minister from 1981 to 1989. For the benefit of your listeners, let me also tell them that I know Mousavi personally. I've met him when he was the prime minister. I've met his wife many times. In fact, we invited her to one of our conferences in 1988, and she stayed at our house. She was our guest. I mean, I know her that closely, and I've had many discussions with her whenever I visited Iran. You know, she was the chancellor of a university. Now she's no longer, but, you know, I've had very, you know, animated discussions with her. Of course, we don't always agree on all the issues, but, you know, I know them personally. I don't know Ahmadinejad personally, but Mousavi was appointed prime minister without ever being elected to that post, because until 1989, under Iran's constitution, the president was to be elected, and then the president would appoint a prime minister, just like you have in France. And that is how Mousavi came to be the prime minister, although he was appointed prime minister by Imam Khomeini. And during the time when Mousavi was prime minister, Khamenei used to be the president of Iran at that time, the leader of Iran today. He used to be the president. And there were, of course, policy differences between the two. And in 1989, there was a constitutional amendment that removed the post of prime minister and concentrated all the executive powers in the hands of the president. So today, there is no prime minister's post. There is only the president's post, and the president has to be elected by direct elections of the people. Now, once Mousavi was no longer the prime minister, then he completely shunned public life. I mean, you know, I've been to Iran many times since 1989, but each time I went there, I sent a message to him to say that I want to come and see you, because I know him as a friend. But he would decline. He wouldn't sort of, you know, say, he would just make excuses that I'm not available, whatever. Although I could go and see other officials, serving officials, retired officials, whatever, but Mousavi never, ever came out in public. I could go and see his wife and talk to her. There is no problem, but he didn't want to meet. And he avoided all journalistic contact. It was not just me, all journalistic contact. So since he the post of prime minister was abolished, of course, he went into seclusion. So the people of Iran really know very little about him. Today's generation know very little about him, except, of course, for the university crowd and so on, because of his wife's work over there, as well as of, you know, his other campaign ally, the former president, Mohammad Khatami, who sort of, you know, has a following among the university crowd and so on, that Mousavi is not known in the rest of the country that well today. Whereas Ahmadinejad, because he has been president for the last 4 years and he has done a lot of work for the rural poor, naturally those people have great respect and regard for him. And when you look at his the percentage of vote that he received this time, which was 62.6%, it is virtually the same percentage that he had received in the final round in the 2005 elections. At that time, his total vote was 61.9%. Today, it's 62.6%, virtually the same figure. So there's absolutely no difference between what he got then and what he has got now. And so that indicates that Ahmadinejad managed to retain his support base, because he actually went and courted the rural poor, and he increased the, you know, salaries of the civil servants and so on. And so the overall, the poor strata of society were very happy with him. It was only the rich and the powerful and some of the corrupt people that didn't like him because he has been going after people who have been involved in corruption, and naturally those people would not like what he is doing.
Well, I mean, the media, they've presented us with a very narrow image of the elections, right? It was one in which they said, I've turned into Stephen Colbert. I got to tell you, you know, the first time that someone mentioned Ahmadinejad on his program, or maybe it was Jon Stewart, he pronounced his name correctly. And then, it was Colbert, because after he pronounced his name correctly and he watched his name being mispronounced by a bunch of Fox News commentators and CNN people, he then began intentionally mispronouncing his name so that he'd feel that he was fitting in with the rest of them. And it was a very funny joke, but it's a bit infectious. Well, I'm just thinking the media had been presenting us with a very narrow view of Ahmadinejad because they showed him as a person that was not drawing large crowds in the cities, in contrast to Mousavi, even though, in fact, the president was drawing large crowds in the cities, for example. And
absolutely. In fact, you know, something last Sunday, for instance, there were media reports were saying, well, you know, Mousavi attracted hundreds of thousands of people. This is correct. But Ahmadinejad attracted hundreds of thousands of people as well. In fact, you know, much more. And yet that was not even mentioned by most television stations. Even yesterday, for instance, Ahmadinejad as well as Mousavi had called for rallies, and Ahmadinejad's people came out first. They had a massive rally over there, and when Mousavi's people arrived over there in the same square, for instance, incidentally, Wali Asr Square, when they realized that Ahmadinejad's people are all already over there, they decided not to hold their rally, although, of course, there were police and others to separate the two groups. But Ahmadinejad's rally was massive, although he himself was not present over there. He was in Russia attending a meeting of various countries discussing economic projects. But even so, there were hundreds of thousands of people attending Ahmadinejad supporters' rally, and obviously, tens of thousands of people supporting or holding a rally in support of Mousavi in North Tehran, but all media reports were simply saying, oh, Mousavi's rally was much bigger. I mean, how did they know that? In fact, you know, Mousavi's supporters were simply marching in the street, whereas Ahmadinejad's rally was in a square, and a whole square completely, it was completely jam-packed. And in fact, it was interesting that his supporters, Ahmadinejad's supporters, were not in any way abusive of Mousavi or any of the other demonstrators. In fact, they constantly urged them. They said, look, the elections have been held. You should respect the wishes of the 40 million people. These people may be poor and dispossessed, but they have just as much right as you, the rich people, have. And so you cannot say that your vote has greater value than the vote of the poor and the downtrodden. And that, you know, we should be united and we should be looking for the well-being of our country, rather than continuing with this kind of, you know, negative campaigning and so on.
Yeah, it was a class vote, I think. And it's like you said, the Western journalists, the foreign journalists, had been ensconced. They had been in the same area as the Mousavi supporters. They had been, you know, in those elite sections of parts of certain cities. And
that's right.
And that's what we got to see. And we didn't get to see the rest of the country, which had majority support for Ahmadinejad. Well, anyway, I guess that's why we have to look at the other side, or we have to really look at the story itself and what's being told to us. And again, that's, people can go to your website, right? That's muslimmedia.org?
.com.
Okay, so let's make sure people know it's muslimmedia.com.
And they Muslim can... Media is with a single M in the middle, so, you know, they should just put Muslim Media, all lower caps, muslimmedia.com, and they would find our comments on the website.
Okay, well, thank you very much, then.
It's a great pleasure, Brandon.
Thank you for being one among the first people to really start investigating this story.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.